Good morning, Goldnox. Welcome to Weather Aware, presented by The Morning Show, Laurier's one and only weather radio talk show. I'm your host, the one and only Liam McGuckin. I want to say good morning on such a cold, cold morning, man. It was freezing. There was frost in the grass this morning. I got a text from a friend in Mississauga that there was frost over there. They had a frost advisory the other day, if you missed that. It's way too early for frost. We're not even in the middle of October. We're not even in double digits of October. I want to remind you, it's October 9th. And we're already seeing frost on the grass. And in Waterloo, this morning, if you were up early enough, you did see weather that felt like minus one. Way too cold. What happened to that nice fall weather we got? I miss that. I dearly miss it. But anyway, I'm glad that you're spending such a cold morning with me for the next 2 hours. It'll be a good show today, folks. It'll be a very good show today. What is in that show? Well, let's find out in the show forecast. In the first hour of the show, you can expect to hear the latest weather news in the aftermath of Hurricane Imelda and Humberto's Fujiwara effect that we discussed last week, Storm Amy, as well as a huge development in EF5 history. I'll then be discussing the 2013 Moore Tornado, a disastrous storm. In the second hour of the show, I'll be discussing Hurricane Clarissa, the hurricane that wiped out Site B, Isla Sorna, in the Jurassic Park franchise, as well as Hurricane Iniki, the real-life hurricane that attacked the island Jurassic Park was filmed on. And, as always, I'll be ending the show with your weekly forecast, my trademark guaranteed 3-day forecast, and your Laurier-exclusive news report. As for the weather recap, I will say I didn't expect it, but there's actually a good amount of stuff to recap. It wasn't as chaotic as a few weeks ago, but there was some chaos in the weather this week. First off, we had the weirdly hot couple of days over the weekend into Monday that we got, and I will say it was noticeably humid, at least here in Waterloo. I haven't heard anything from Mississauga if it was humid over there, but at least here in Waterloo, it was pretty humid for October, at least during the day. Noticed it really on Sunday. I went out for a nice walk on Sunday, and it was weirdly humid. I don't know. It was just odd. The weather overall has been odd for the last couple days, overall the last week or so. It's just been weird, but I'm not complaining about the weird hot weather we got because weather-wise, it was gorgeous outside. Absolutely gorgeous. Got blue skies, clear sun beaming down on you. Just a beautiful sight to see and a beautiful thing to wake up to. Then, after all that, come overnight into Tuesday. Sorry, I lost my track there. Then come overnight into Tuesday, and that strong cold front I mentioned last week comes into play. We got some heavy rain. Mississauga also got some heavy rain, which we both got it early in the morning. So again, if you woke up early enough, you did end up getting a lot of rain poured down on you. So hope you had an umbrella. Other than that, in the early morning, we did get some more rain later on in the afternoon. Heavy at times, but at least in Waterloo, but mostly calm, or not calm, but it was moderate rain, at least. It was moderate rain. But other than that, it was in general a colder and cloudier day. All I have to say about Tuesday can be summed up by my good friend, Other Liam. Not working? Hold on. Oh, my bad, folks. All right, yeah, so anything I have to say about Tuesday can be summed up by my good friend, Other Liam.
Don't you just love it? A little bit of chaos when the weather comes. Don't you just...
Indeed. Couldn't have said it better, Other Liam. I like it, at least, when a little bit of chaos with the weather comes. I don't know about you, but sometimes a good rainstorm is needed. Since that faithful cold front arrived, we finally transitioned into what I've come to call weather's awkward teenage phase. You'll probably notice how it's freezing cold in the mornings, but by like 2 p.m., you won't need it anymore. We're starting to get into that weird phase in fall, where it's not really fall, but it's not really winter either. It's that weird transition period, where in the mornings, you're going to need more winter gear. Like, I'm wearing a coat right now. Remember, my dad told me to bring this coat. And I told him, oh, I won't need it. I won't need it till like November. Here I am, wearing the coat, and I need it on October 9th. But I know as soon as I leave the studio, it'll be warm enough to where I don't need this coat anymore. So there's that. I don't really like it temperature-wise because you don't know how to dress. I'd honestly rather have consistently hot days or consistently cold days over what we're getting now, where it's going to be cold in the mornings and then warm in the day and then cold at night, because whatever I wear in the morning is not going to be suitable for what I wear in the afternoon. So it's just tough. It's tough. It's complicated, and I don't appreciate it, but I won't complain too much because we're still seeing that bright, beautiful sun during all this, so not all is lost. At least for now. More on that later, but at least right now, we're still seeing that nice, beautiful sun. As I mentioned, Mississauga and surrounding areas saw their very first frost advisory of the season yesterday for this morning, and that came to fruition. To all the Waterloonies, which apparently that's what the Royal Air Force called people from Waterloo, Waterloonies. This morning was that faded -1 degree weather. I will note that it was a freezing walk to the station. As I mentioned, I did need that coat. So hopefully it warms up soon. I'm not a fan of this cold weather, at least not this early on in the year. But what are you going to do about it? And in some non-weather-related recap news, the Blue Jays won against the New York Yankees in a 5-2 loss, over double the score New York got. They now officially advance to the American League Championships, which is pretty cool. So I gotta say this, it's looking very promising for the Blue Jays. It's looking very promising. Go, Jays, go. Moving into the forecast accuracy, it's pretty short, but I'll say that my forecast was pretty solid, all things considered. You know, as predicted, moving into Wednesday, we had that steep decline in temperature, and we did see the cold front move in with the aforementioned risk of rain I had for Tuesday. It was also abnormally hot, which I also forecasted, so there's that as well. My forecasts tend to be pretty accurate when we're dealing with less complicated weather, at least temperature-wise. Once we're getting to more storms and stuff, it's harder to predict that kind of stuff, but there's no storms right now, so we can do some more calmer forecasting. We're going to go on a short break now. It's currently 10:09, 8 degrees, feels like 7, so you're going to have a little bit of a wind chill, but overall it still feels pretty crisp outside. But it is sunny with clear skies in Waterloo, Ontario. I don't know about you, but personally, I hope you can agree here at least. It's just way too early for these temperatures. Like, how was there frost this morning in the grass? And it's not even middle of October yet. But it's not like the opposite we got is nice either. Close to 30 degrees with humidity isn't nice for October at all. Is it really too much to ask for just another week of that nice fall weather we got last week? those mid-teen temperatures, the clear blue skies, beautiful sun, lovely trees with pretty leaves. Frankly, gonna play us into the break with I Want It All by Queen on Radio Laurier. Welcome back from the break, and welcome back to Weather Aware with Liam, presented by The Morning Show. If you didn't catch the show last week, we covered the epic display of the Fujiwara effect with Hurricane Imelda and Umberto, which turned into Storm Amy, which ravaged the UK and surrounding areas over the weekend. Today is the follow-up to that story. What happened with Storm Amy? How strong was it? Let's find out. But before anything, though, just to get out of the way, because the story does involve a lot of these, I figured I should explain how the UK goes about their weather warnings, because it's a tiny bit different. See, they use a three-color system to base its weather warnings around: yellow, orange, and red. Yellow means that the weather doesn't pose a threat to the general population, but does possibly pose a threat to a localized area, and that people should be weather aware. This may be used for stuff like isolated severe thunderstorms, isolated events. Orange means there are infrequent and dangerous weather conditions that may pose a threat to life and property, and to prepare yourself for the storm. This might be used for something like more widespread thunderstorms. Red means rare and very dangerous weather conditions from intense meteorological phenomena are present, and to protect yourself and your property. This might be used for stuff like a tornado warning. So, with that out of the way, our story picks up on October 1st. The two hurricanes have merged into one, Storm Amy. Very imposing and threatening, I know. Storm Amy would start making its way towards the UK and its surrounding areas, with wind gusts reaching peaks of 224 kilometers per hour. This was a dangerous situation about to unfold for the UK as well as some surrounding areas. The next day, on October 2nd, the Met Office issued an orange wind warning covering much of northwestern Scotland from 5 p.m. on October 3rd to 9 a.m. on October 4th. A further yellow wind warning was in place across Northern Ireland, Scotland, and parts of England from 5 p.m. on October 3rd to midnight on October 4th. A yellow warning for rain was also issued for Northern England, Ireland, not England, and Scotland. England would end up getting the less damaging effects of Storm Amy, mainly lots of flooding issues, unfortunately, though. It would end up flooding the River Duddon, causing the A595 road to also flood and cause a power outage for over 1,000 people in Cumbria. It would also cause flooding at Earlswood Railway Station, where a tree blocked a railway line between Rye and Ashford International. The Patterdale Mountain Rescue Team spent 5 hours rescuing a group of 13 people from Great Dodd amid winds of up to 130 kilometers per hour, during which 2 people were injured. 3 men were trapped in a cave also in the Yorkshire Dales due to flooding for over 30 hours before getting rescued by over 100 volunteers. Moving into Northern Ireland, a gust of 148 kilometers per hour was recorded at the weather station in McGilligan, which is a new record for October, while over 65,000 properties lost power. TransLink closed all rail lines in Northern Ireland, and numerous roads were closed across the country, including the Foyle Bridge and parts of the M1 and M22 motorways. A large number of flights were impacted, with 13 being cancelled at Belfast International Airport and another at Derry Airport. The Education Authority said 18 schools had reported incidents to them by midday on October 4th, which were mainly damaged roofs and fallen trees. On October 5th, Northern Ireland electricity said around 1,500 properties were still without power. Liz Kimmins, the Minister of Infrastructure, said that 1,457 incidents, including 1,018 obstructions and over 350 floods, had been reported to her department. In Ireland in general, not just Northern Ireland, their meteorological people issued an orange wind warning for the counties of Donegal, Galway, Leitrim, Mayo, and Sligo. From 2 to 10 p.m. on October 3rd, whilst the whole country was under a status yellow warning until midnight. On October 3rd, a red wind warning was issued for County Donegal from 4 to 6 p.m., advising residents to shelter in place, whilst a red marine warning was issued between Loophead and Fairhead from 2 to 8 p.m. Orange warnings were issued for Donegal, Leitrim, and Sligo counties from 4 to 8 a.m. for October 4th, whilst Clare, Dublin, Galway, Kerry, Louth, Mayo, and Wicklow counties were under yellow warnings until midday. On October 3rd, someone died in what was described as, quote, a weather-related incident, very broad term, don't know what that's about, in Letterkenny, as a gust of 148 kilometers per hour was recorded at Malinhead. Over 184,000 homes were without power across Ireland, whilst 115 flights were canceled at Dublin Airport, with 18 others diverted. Lots going on in Ireland. But moving into Scotland now, a gust of 154 kilometers per hour was recorded at Tiree, whilst power cuts were reported in the Highlands. In Glasgow, a derelict building collapsed onto a car amid high winds, forcing the road to close. A train traveling between Aberdeen and Inverurie hit a fallen tree, leaving around a dozen passengers fortunately stranded on the train. The Forth Road Bridge was closed whilst high-sided vehicles were expected to be prevented from crossing, and this is a real thing. What I'm about to say, this is a real name. This is why I love the UK and European names in general. Whilst high-sided vehicles were expected to be prevented from crossing the Clackmannanshire Bridge, Kincardine Bridge, Tyne Bridge, and possibly the Queen's Ferry Crossing. Awesome name, dude. Clackmannanshire? That's so cool. Love that stuff. Love that stuff. By October 4th, over 75,000 homes had lost power across Scotland, as Network Rail Scotland said over 170 incidents had occurred across its network. A large sign was torn off a shop near Inverness, and the boundary wall at Lynx Park in Montrose was blown over. Competition at the Alfred Dunhill Lynx Championship was suspended, and some events at the Great Scottish Run were cancelled. The storm had a central pressure. I'm not going to mention the pressure. I haven't explained pressure yet. But the pressure of the storm set a new record. On October 5th, Scottish and Southern electricity networks said they had restored power to 71,000 homes, although 17,000 remained disconnected. Meanwhile, Network Rail Scotland said its teams had attended over 420 incidents, including debris, fallen trees, and flooding blocking further railway lines. As the storm moved further inland, France would start issuing weather alerts. On October 3rd, Météo France placed 55 departments in the northern half of the country on yellow alerts for wind, with some also receiving warnings for rain, storm surges, and thunderstorms. The following day, 6 departments were placed on orange alert for strong winds. On October 4th, one man died after drowning in Étretat, whilst a tree fell on a car in Ain, leaving one man dead and another seriously injured. A gust of 134 kilometers per hour was recorded in the Baie de Somme as a home had its roof torn off completely in Hervilly. Over 13,000 people were left without power in Normandy. And after all of that, Storm Amy would dissipate 2 days later after causing some more minor damage in some other surrounding countries, and this two-week saga of the Fujiwara effect comes to a close. I think the key takeaway of this story is that the UK has some really awesome names. Again, I'm going to shout out Clackman and Shirebridge. Love that name. But all because it's the end of that story doesn't mean it's the end of weather news for this week. Yes, there is a second, smaller weather story to cover, but a big one at that. So, for a bit of pretense or context, whatever you want to call it, the weather community has been avid about reclassifying certain tornadoes for a while now that have happened over the course of the past couple years. Anytime a tornado formed on the ground, you always had meteorologists on social media convinced that this would be the one to break the drought, or people going, did we just break the EF5 drought? But it never happened. People were doing this because the last EF5 tornado was all the way back in 2013, making for a 12-year drought of zero EF5-rated tornadoes, a record-breaking amount of time. Let it be known that this did not mean there weren't tornadoes at an EF5 level. Many EF4s, and on very, very rare cases, even EF3s, can have the same intensity and scale of an EF5. It's just that for 12 years, not a single tornado produced enough damage to be rated as an EF5, as the Fujita scale rates tornadoes based off of the damage severity, not the intensity of the storm itself. So there have been many tornadoes with possibly the same intensity as an EF5, but not the same damage severity as an EF5. Lots of tornado fans have been fiending for an EF5, and nobody knew when it would happen. Including me. I wasn't going around saying, oh, this is the one to break the EF5 drought, but I have been wondering when we're going to get an EF5 tornado, because it has been 12 years. Little did I know that out of all the tornadoes to happen, it would be the one to happen on a very ironic date for me. I want you all to flash back to the middle of June. You guys are probably a month into summer break or just relaxing in the middle of June, as was I. But in the middle of June, specifically June 20th, I was celebrating my birthday. Little did I know that it would be a day of sadness and sorrow for many in the town of Enderlin, North Dakota, where, as part of a larger outbreak in Derrico, a tornado would form and devastate the town in close to the middle of the night at around 11 p.m. I was playing the new Mario Kart. I was having the time of my life, so I was oblivious to the storm happening. See, it was originally rated as an EF3 tornado with winds of 260 kilometers per hour, but upon re-examination from the National Weather Service in Grand Forks, they upgraded it to an EF5 tornado with winds of over 340 kilometers per hour based on the lofting on train cars, of all things. Who saw that coming? I sure didn't. This was officially confirmed on October 6th, 2025, on a random Monday, about a tornado that happened months and months ago. And I know this doesn't probably seem as important as something like the more usual weather news I cover, like Storm Amy or the two hurricanes from last week. Trust me, I agree. It's not as important, but I figured it would still be a good topic to cover because I think it's still important. It's big news, at least in the weather community, as the 12-year drought for EF tornadoes, which is a record, has finally been broken. Called a twisted late birthday present of sorts. We're going to go on a short break now. It's currently 10:28. 8 degrees, still have a small wind chill, so it's going to feel a little chilly, feel like 7 degrees. But the sun is still out and shining, so it's not the end of the world in Waterloo, Ontario. I think the scariest part of this Enderlin tornado is that it happened in the dead of night. While I was still celebrating my birthday, I gotta start unmuting this thing. My bad, guys. Let me start over with that. I think the scariest part of the Enderlin tornado is that it happened in the dead of night. While I was still celebrating my birthday, Enderlin had to beware of darkness. George Harrison on Radio Laurier. Watch out now. Take a welcome back from the break, and welcome back to Weather Aware with Liam, presented by The Morning Show. That last song was used in Weapons, by the way, which I definitely still recommend seeing it if you haven't already. Maybe a good thing to do during reading week. Who knows? I think it's still playing in cinemas, but even if not, it's out on digital now. So with Halloween coming up, it might be a good thing to get together with your friends, get some nice snacks, and watch a solid horror movie. Anywho, for 12 years, we had that EF5 drought, finally being broken this week by my late birthday present. But what was the last EF5 tornado we had prior to this? What happened 12 years ago to kick off this drought? Well, that would be the tornado that touched down in Moore, Oklahoma on May 20th, 2013. It would end up being an extremely violent tornado, which makes it all the more interesting to report on. What happened? How did it form? How strong was it? All those questions and more will be answered today in this segment. But first off, you can answer the question on how did it form with the meteorological synopsis, which is always needed with these kind of storm recaps. On May 20th, 2013, a prominent central upper trough, which is a dip in the atmosphere, which brings cooler and, you know, more chaotic weather to us on the ground, moved eastward toward the central United States with a lead upper low pressure system, which brings, again, colder and more chaotic weather, pivoting over the Dakotas and upper Midwest region. A southern stream shortwave trough and a moderately strong polar jet moved east-northeastward. Over the southern Rockies to the southern Great Plains and Ozarks area, with severe thunderstorms forming during the peak time of heating. With the influence of moderately strong cyclonic flow aloft, the air mass was expected to become unstable across much of the southern Great Plains, Ozarks, and Middle Mississippi Valley by the afternoon. So, with unstable weather expected, the Storm Prediction Center issued a moderate risk of severe thunderstorm potential during the early morning of May 20th from southeast Missouri to north central Texas. Ingredients in the atmosphere, which was wind shear, moisture, and instability, all pointed towards supercell development. Large hail and tornadoes were expected, with some strong ones expected as well. Or at least they were likely. A tornado watch would be issued for most of eastern Oklahoma, northwest Arkansas, and portions of north central Texas in the afternoon of May 20th. So, the watches are in place. People are getting ready. It wouldn't be for another hour until the storm that would eventually produce the tornado would develop, around 2 p.m. Storm warnings are issued, and with rapid intensification, it caught a lot of attention. NBC, ABC, and CBS would all suspend their programming to go into wall-to-wall weather coverage immediately after the tornado watch would go into effect. Fox affiliate Channel 25 and Telemundo affiliate Channel 30 would begin their coverage as the first severe thunderstorms erupted southwest of the state capital, subsequently beginning relaying their audio feeds to radio stations throughout central Oklahoma. As the severe thunderstorm ravaged the county and the clock kept ticking, parents began to get worried. See, it was starting to rotate, and it was around the same time when school would be let out, which is a crucial sign of the beginning of a tornado, the rotation. parents would go and pick up their children in advance. Around 2:40, this rotation was first spotted and increasing at the cloud base, and a tornado warning would be issued for southern Oklahoma counties as it approached the Oklahoma City metropolitan area. As meteorologists on air prepare for the worst and families start hunkering down, just 16 minutes later, the tornado would touch down. And this is where our story starts. Starting out, it would touch down in the McLean County. After doing minor damage to a home and some trees, it would cross the SH-37, which is a highway, and rapidly intensify as it struck a semi-rural subdivision. Several homes would be destroyed, two of which were leveled at an EF4 intensity. It would also grow in size, going from a noodle-looking pathetic funnel to a more barrel-shaped tornado, with a debris ball growing around the funnel as it evolved finally into this giant wedge-shaped tornado. It would cause a tornado emergency to be issued for southern Oklahoma City and more. As it moved into south Oklahoma City, it maintained at least an EF3 intensity as it crossed the Canadian River, which I know is confusing, but it's a river in Oklahoma, into Cleveland County. The tornado then continued moving east-northeastward through the extreme southern portion of Oklahoma City towards Moore, roughly following southwest 149th Street. At that point, it began to go rapidly in width, and a second brief area of EF4 damage was noted near South May Avenue, where several homes were leveled and one was swept clean from its foundation. As the tornado began to cross into South Oklahoma City, a traffic jam had occurred for a stretch of several miles along the Santa Fe Avenue, as residents attempted to either escape from or pick up their children at schools located near the tornado's path. As the station's news helicopter was capturing live video of the tornado, Chief Meteorologist Gary England, upon seeing footage of the backup that was being relayed by pilot Jim Gardner, urged drivers caught in the jam that may have been listening to the station's audio simulcast on area radio outlets to nearby radios to use nearby streets to detour out of the tornado's expected track. Thankfully, a lot of people avoided what could have been a disastrous situation, thanks to Gary England. The tornado would briefly weaken to EF3 strength before re-intensifying to EF4 intensity near Foreman Drive, flattening several homes as it moved through mostly rural areas south of Southwest 149th Street. The tornado continued east, heavily scouring an open grassy field before impacting Briarwood Elementary School, which was completely destroyed. The National Weather Service originally rated this damage EF5, but further evaluation and a 2014 study published by the American Meteorological Society, it's a tough word, revealed evidence of poor construction at the school, and the rating was downgraded to an EF4. Remarkably, no fatalities occurred at the school. It's a very good thing parents were there to pick up their kids. Past Briarwood Elementary, the tornado would intensify even further and enter densely populated areas just west of Moore, including the Westmore subdivision, where many well-built anchor-bolted brick homes were flattened at EF4 intensity, and two were swept clean from their foundations, with damage at those two homes rated EF5. Moving into Moore, Oklahoma, the tornado continued generally northeast of at EF4 strength, completely debarking trees and leveling entire neighborhoods as it moved into the western city limits of Moore, Oklahoma. Many homes were flattened in neighborhoods to the east of South Santa Fe Avenue. The tornado was initially rated EF5 in this area as only the bare slab of an anchor bolted home remained, but it was later downgraded to an EF4 as an inspection revealed the home's anchor bolts were missing their nuts and washers. Essentially, it wasn't bolted to the ground well, and it was downgraded to EF4 because it wasn't technically the tornado did doing all the work. It was also the faulty craftsmanship of the house, technically. The tornado then destroyed Plaza Towers Elementary School at EF4 intensity, where 7 fatalities occurred. More than a dozen homes in a subdivision just to the south of Plaza Towers Elementary were completely swept away, all revealed to have been nailed rather than bolted to their foundations, which EF4 intensity. Damage to the subdivision was subsequently, again, rated EF4, though the tornado was likely violent as lawns were completely scoured down to the bare soil. Entire blocks of homes were flattened, trees were completely debarked, and vehicles were thrown and mangled. The ground was severely scoured in other residential areas nearby. The damage also earned an EF4 rating in these areas. Most of the fatalities from the tornado occurred in the Plaza Towers neighborhood of Moore. In one of these houses, which is a block away from the school that got destroyed, a woman was killed as she was tried to seek shelter in a closet, which, if you didn't know, that's a big no-no. If a tornado ever comes your way, what you want to do is you want to get yourself and everyone around you into either the lowest point in your house, like a basement, or somewhere with no windows. Something like a bathroom might work. The goal is to get yourself somewhere where the tornado would have difficulty sucking you out. In a closet, in a room full of windows, a closet itself is a door, so you're essentially hiding behind a door. So a closet is very easy to get sucked out of when you're dealing with a tornado. So how to take the chance to plug some tornado safety, because this kind of stuff is very important. Even if our areas don't really get tornadoes that often at all, it's good to know in case you are somewhere where a tornado does occur. Further to the northeast, at least a dozen cars were piled up against the front entrance of the Moore Medical Center, which sustained EF4 damage. One car was lofted and then thrown onto the roof of the medical center. Many homes and neighborhoods near the medical center were completely destroyed, including a row of 4 well-built brick homes with anchor bolts that were swept away, with damage to those 4 homes being rated in EF5 because of how well the homes were built. An open field directly behind this row of homes was deeply scoured, with only bare soil and clumps of dirt remaining. A bowling alley and a 7-Eleven would both also be completely flattened. The tornado would continue through Moore's eastern neighborhoods. Highland East Junior High's main building was spared, but the separate gym building was completely destroyed, and a set of lockers from the structure were thrown a considerable distance into a nearby neighborhood. The Moore Public Schools Administration Building, which was a converted former hospital, located a few blocks to the east, was also struck and destroyed. The tornado, thankfully, was starting to get smaller at this point. It did look pretty narrow compared to the more wedge-like structure it had, but it was still causing a bunch of EF4 damage. A well-built anchor-bolted home at the corner of Heatherwood Drive and Southeast 5th Street was reduced to a bare slab, sustaining EF5 damage. Debris was scattered well away from the site. A vehicle was thrown over 91 meters, and after all of this, it would finally start showing signs of weakening, and it would dissipate at 3:35 p.m., meaning the tornado would be gone. It traveled roughly 22 kilometers over the course of almost 40 minutes, moving at a rate of 34 kilometers per hour. At its peak, it was 1,737 meters wide. So that was the storm itself, but here are some of the impacts left behind. The Oklahoma Department of Emergency Management reported that 25 people were killed, with another death indirectly attributed to the tornado. The Oklahoma Medical Examiner recognizes 25 fatalities as well. An estimated 1,150 homes were destroyed, resulting in an estimated $2 billion in damages. The number of injured people was 377 people. There were entire subdivisions obliterated, houses flattened, neighborhoods especially the majority of one just west of the Moore Medical Center, being destroyed. Witnesses had said that the tornado more closely resembled a giant black wall of destruction rather than a typical tornado. Among the hardest hit areas was the two public schools I mentioned, Briarwood Elementary School and Plaza Towers Elementary School. It was said that at Briarwood Elementary School, that structural engineers found some structural deficiencies that led to its collapse during the tornado, meaning it was not as well built as it should have been. It was determined that the building's walls that were not reinforced with concrete had been a lack, and that there had been a lack of connection between the masonry walls and support beams in several portions of the building, and that the anchor bolts were pulled from the ground of the tornado. So the school in general, as I mentioned, was not as well built as it should have been, and that plays a part into why it was completely destroyed. At Plaza Towers Elementary, parents had been allowed to collect their children early in preparation for the storm. So by the time the tornado struck, only about 75 students and teachers were in the building. Many students and teachers took shelter in bathrooms and closets, but in a newer addition to the building, which housed the school's second and third grade classrooms, 7 fatalities occurred. These fatalities obviously include some of the children. So I'm not going to go into detail about the deaths of children, but if you really want to read about that, you can read about it yourself if you want to know. In the aftermath of the storm, Oklahoma Governor Mary Follin declared a state of emergency on May 20th. She held her first post-tornado news conference at noon on May 21st. The Federal Emergency Management Agency deployed urban search and rescue teams to the tornado-hit areas and provided incident command personnel to organize and support rescue efforts. Governor Mary Follin requested assistance from then-President Barack Obama, who declared a major disaster in the state and ordered federal aid to the affected areas. Governor Follin quickly dismissed an idea. Hold on one second. I'm getting texts from my parents. Gotta check this. Music is too loud. Hard to hear you. Talk. Oh, okay. My bad, guys. Thought it was... All right. My bad. I got a text from my parents. Just had to check that out. All right. Yeah. So Governor Follin quickly... Where was I? That's right. From then-President Barack Obama, who declared a major disaster in the state and ordered federal aid to the affected areas. Governor Follin quickly dismissed an idea to make a law that would require all schools in Oklahoma to have a shelter that would protect children during severe weather, which I personally find ridiculously stupid to dismiss such an idea. I'd figure that in Oklahoma, which is famously known for their awful tornadoes, was even used as the big third act in Twisters, which is a tornado weather movie, I find it ridiculously stupid that she would dismiss an idea to keep children safe and build more storm shelters in a state that gets more tornadoes than most of the other states. That, personally, that just seems like bad planning on their part. Like, I just gotta say that. I don't know if it was a funding issue or what, but I would assume that in Oklahoma, of all states, which is big in Tornado Alley, I'd figure that that would be the first place to issue some kind of law that requires you build a storm shelter in all of the schools so that you could prevent the possible endangerment and death of children during storms. But what do I know? Anywho, there were many donations that were taken to help those impacted by the storm. Most notably, donations were taken from the Canadian Red Cross, Kevin Durant, Hobby Lobby, and Carrie Underwood. On May 29th, 2013, NBC aired Healing in the Heartland Relief Benefit Concert, which is a fundraising concert that was held at Chesapeake Energy Arena in downtown Oklahoma City. It raised $6 million. And there were a lot of documentary specials to come out, most notably of which was the Discovery Channel airing an hour-long documentary about the storm titled Mile Wide Tornado, Oklahoma Disaster. The documentary provided a really strong and good look at the tornado's impact and drew comparisons of the storm to the 1999 Bridge Creek Moore tornado. I can definitely recommend this one. I've seen it. It's a very good documentary, and it's honored in the name of four storm chasers who died in a storm that happened not too long after the Moore tornado. If that documentary sounds familiar to some long-term listeners, it would be because it would also bring up the El Reno tornado, which was a tornado that fascinates me the most. This might sound grim, I know, but I have a favorite tornado that's happened, and that is the El Reno tornado. I remember seeing a really cool documentary about it as a kid, and I think that's honestly what got me into tornadoes and weather in general. So I guess something good came out of the El Reno tornado. But that tornado would happen and strike Oklahoma City 11 days later. So I have no clue what was up with May 2013 and violent tornadoes. And that El Reno tornado, if you didn't know, would become the widest tornado on record. So no clue what was up, but May 2013 was going very hard with the weather. And that would be the last EF5 tornado, not El Reno, but the Moore 2013 tornado. That would happen until June 20th, 2025, I guess, until my 19th birthday. So from 2013 to 2025, you had this huge EF5 tornado drought. And yeah, I find this stuff fascinating. I don't know if you do, but I find this stuff very fascinating. Tornadoes are my favorite kind of storm. I can't explain it, but they are just very fascinating to look at. I think it's also in part of all the documentaries creating this really cool narrative with the intense music and the witness perspectives and the found footage and all that stuff. I think it's a combination of that and just how interesting it is to study and look at tornadoes both on the radar and on the ground from videos I've seen. But yeah, it's some pretty cool stuff. That being said, we're going to go on a short break now. It is currently 10:55, 10 degrees, feels like 9, so it's warmed up a good bit. And it is still sunny, so it's only going to warm up from here, which is a good thing, in Waterloo, Ontario. This was a pretty tragic tale, but to end off on a more positive note, the city has used this as a learning experience and can now handle tornadoes better than ever. They banded together and helped each other. The city has since bounced back and is still standing better than they ever did, looking like a true survivor. Gonna play us into the break with I'm Still Standing by Elton John on Radio Laurier. Welcome back from the break, and welcome back to Weather Aware with Liam, presented by The Morning Show. Moving into a drastically different topic, on the surface, the Jurassic Park franchise doesn't seem to be this whole Laurel Ridge franchise. You know, it's simply just man plays God, dinosaurs get loose on an island, and people get eaten in very cool ways. At least they used to get eaten in pretty cool ways. But that could not be further from the truth. At its core, coming from a diehard fan, so you can trust my judgment here, it's a franchise filled with mysteries regarding biogenetic companies, hybrid dinosaurs, and a plethora of things in between. You know, I could go on for hours about this stuff, but there is one mystery that trumps them all, and one that I will try to answer today. Hurricane Clarissa. A lot of you that have seen at least Jurassic Park, when I say that name, are probably thinking of the first movie's hurricane, the one that hits Isla Nublar and causes all the issues in the second act, I guess in the third act, alongside Dennis Nedry's nonsense. But just to clarify here, that was not Hurricane Clisha, but rather a real hurricane that happened in real life, turned into a fictional storm. The real hurricane was Hurricane Iniki, which I will be covering in the next topic. In fact, nobody knew about Hurricane Clisha until the second movie, The Lost World, where it was first mentioned. Some important context you should know, because in my life, I have met in total like 3 Jurassic Park fans in person, other than people in my family. So I'm just going off the assumption that not a lot of people know this stuff, so I'm going to give you some important context, because without it, I'm going to sound like a nut job. So, there are 2 main islands in the movies. You have Isla Nublar and Isla Sorna. Isla Nublar is where the theme parks, Jurassic Park and Jurassic World, the parks themselves, not the movies, technically the movies too, but the theme parks themselves, were built and opened. Isla Sorna, which is known as Site B, is where the dinosaurs were originally engineered and made. If you haven't seen any of these movies, I do have one thing that a lot of, at least people my age, have probably seen. Recently on like TikTok and Instagram, there's been a rise in edits of movies and stuff like that. And you have probably seen Isla Sorna in the form of those Spinosaurus TikTok edits with Animal I Have Become in the background. Those are a real thing. I find them hilarious. Anywho, in the second movie, in a scene with Ian Malcolm, played by the lovely Jeff Goldblum, and John Hammond, played by the legendary Sir Richard Attenborough, which, fun fact, my bearded dragon is named after him and his brother David Attenborough. Hopefully she comes out of Brumation for reading week. I would love to see her coming out of her cave. But anyway, in that scene, John Hammond says that Hurricane Clisha wiped out Site B. Call it an act of God. We had to evacuate, of course, and the animals were released to mature on their own. Life will find a way, as you so once eloquently put it. Sounds like a really interesting plot point with the storm, doesn't it? You know, you'd assume that at some point in the franchise, they would elaborate more or, you know, even make a short project or movie about it, right? It would not be mentioned again in the movies until 2022. Where Dr. Wu, which is played by B.D. Wong, mentions how Charlotte Lockwood, she's a newer character I don't really care for, honestly, lived with them on Site B until, quote-unquote, the storm arrived. So it's almost used as a way to try and get longtime fans to get hooked again into Jurassic World Dominion, which, look, I am a big fan of these movies, but I don't think in good faith I can recommend Jurassic World Dominion. It was, had a cool concept, had a cool promise, but it was plagued with locusts and weird scientific stuff, and half the movie took place again on an isolated island when the movie was supposed to take place all across the mainland, and It's this whole thing. I could go on for hours about this stuff. But I'll say the movie did have some cool dinosaur designs in it. And me personally, you know, with this whole Storm Clarissa thing, I'm still very, very disappointed that they haven't attempted to tackle a project showing what specifically happened with Site B during or after what happened with the hurricane. You know, personally, I think it could be a really, really cool project. And I think it's exactly what the franchise needs right now. But, you know, I mentioned it on my first show. You know, Rebirth was fun. It was good. I rewatched it the other day. I think for what it is, it's pretty good. It's not anything special, but it's good. Great start to the new franchise, don't get me wrong. But I think that they could create a much more complex and thoughtful project, if you want to call it, by filling in these gaps between the original three movies to explain this stuff. And I think a lot of fans would appreciate being able to go back to Isla Sorna, see those animals again, possibly. Just go back to Jurassic Park's era of storytelling and stuff like that, because I love that era of storytelling, and I think there's a lot to still be told. But for all I know, they're probably just going to make another one with Scarlett Johansson, for all I know. I do think I know why they haven't attempted to make a movie about Hurricane Clarissa, though. See, as many know, or at least as many should know, Jurassic Park, the original movie, and its sequel, the movie I'm talking about today, The Lost World, are both based off of novels from Michael Crichton, which are fantastic books, by the way. I'll definitely recommend them. Please, that's another thing to do during reading week. You can read the first two Jurassic Park novels. Fantastic novels. But in these novels, there are a lot of differences. Now, me personally, I find the first book is honestly more similar to the second movie than the first movie for some reason. But one of these differences is that InGen, which is the company behind Jurassic Park, the second movie, the big main dinosaur company, that InGen would not survive the original park incident. See, in the novel, InGen would file for bankruptcy after having to pay off all the families and damages and other stuff from the original Jurassic Park incident. But in the movies, because of certain changes and character deaths and whatnot, a lot more characters survive, and thus, InGen does not go bankrupt. But if they were going to do a second movie and follow the plot line of the second novel, which was a team going onto this abandoned InGen research village and abandoned InGen site, they would have to come up with some kind of reason or excuse to abandon Isla Sorna. As that is, again, that's the driving force of the second novel and the plot of the movie. So, they opted to just say, you know, a hurricane hit the island. Fans won't look into it that much. It's just a hurricane. It's a tropical island. This happens all the time. Don't worry about it. Hurricane hit the island and destroyed it without much thought. You know, just look at these cool dinosaurs. Isn't that cool? You guys don't care about this hurricane, right? The important and sad thing about Hurricane Clarissa is that on its surface, it's nothing more than an afterthought, a simple afterthought for The Lost World. And it's just an excuse to have the island abandoned if it wasn't due to bankruptcy. They didn't really intend on ever going more into depth about this hurricane idea, which sucks. You know, they could always come back to the idea. Hell, they got the co-writer to the original movie back for a rebirth. Anything's possible. But I think this is the reason for why this whole Hurricane Clarissa never came back, except for the one dangling keys moment in Jurassic World Rebirth. Not Rebirth, Dominion. But this thankfully did not stop fans from coming up with their own consensus through what crumbs were left from Trespasser, which is a video game, and the movie The Lost World. Here's the facts that we know. So, in The Lost World, John Hammond says that for 4 years now, I've fought to keep the dinosaurs safe from meddling. While no dates are set, it does imply, or at least mean, that he's been fighting since 1993, 4 years from 1997, when the movie came out, to keep the Site B dinosaurs safe, which implies it's been abandoned since 1993. But in the original script for The Lost World, John Hammond would say that about 24 months ago, Hurricane Clarissa wiped out Site B. Since the movies, at least up until Rebirth, which kind of messed the whole timeline stuff up, take place in the same time as they released, 24 months from May 1997 is May 1995. It was cut from the movie, but later on a video game Jurassic Park Trespasser would bring it back. See, Jurassic Park Trespasser was released as a sort of tie-in for The Lost World a year later in 1998, and mentioned how islands in the region have, which is the region around Isla Sorna, have been under government quarantine since June 1995. Coastal Patrol subsidized via InGen funding initiative. After the storm hit Isla Sorna, InGen would obviously lose control of the island, and I would imagine the government entities in question would want to keep an island full of prehistoric dinosaurs with who knows what diseases and danger under full quarantine after a hurricane came and wrecked everything. It would also wreck a scientific lab full of experimental genetic work, bioengineering stuff, all that crap. So it makes sense that a government entity would want to quarantine the island after it got wrecked by a hurricane. And it also would line up with the real-life hurricane science, as the 1995 hurricane season would start in June of 1995. And since the movies do go off of real-life, at least dates, I'd imagine they would go off of real-life seasons as well, which would include hurricane seasons. So, given that, you know, I personally believe that the storm hit Isla Sorna in June of 1995. The parts of the InGen facilities we see in The Lost World, honestly, in my opinion, just don't look as abandoned as it would be if the storm happened straight after the events of the original movie. You know, camps are still there, buildings are mostly intact, it's mainly just some plant growth and broken windows. You can also still very obviously see some of the original Jurassic Park animals on the island in the second movie. For example, the female velociraptors in the movie are almost identical to the ones from the first movie. If it was abandoned in 1993, personally, I would think there would be at least a decline in the amount of these Jurassic Park-looking raptors and more of the vibrant tiger raptors. And this is exactly what we see in Jurassic Park 3. We see these drastically different-looking velociraptors, new pteranodons, new T-Rexes, new dinosaurs in general. That is what I would imagine Isla Sorna would be like if the storm had happened all the way back in 1993, 4 years before the movie came out. Versus 2 years, I think a 2-year abandonment period makes more sense to me. The only contradiction to this idea is the line that Hammond mentions in the movie itself that was kept in the movie. You know, how he's been trying to keep the dinosaurs on Isla Sorna safe for 4 years, implying there's been a change of leadership of sorts in InGen, but he still has a part in the company, but also implying that the island's been abandoned for 4 years. My way of seeing this, though, is that it can be a double-edged sword for both arguments as to when the storm happened. See, in the original movie, he no longer endorses the theme park Jurassic Park after the whole incident. He also very clearly could see that Hammond still cared for these animals and was sad to abandon them as, you know, he thought they would die. They essentially put a lysine contingency in the animals, meaning that the only food they were only the food that they were fed from the park workers would keep them alive. And if they weren't given the right food and chemicals, after a week or so, they'd kick the bucket. So, from my perspective, I could argue that John Hammond went back to Site B and freed the animals, knowing that he can still give the best life he can for some animals, at least on one of these islands. When the hurricane hit, though, he was forced to abandon the island and its dinosaurs, but seeing that they flourished, he still fought to keep them safe and alive. I don't think that the quote inherently means that he abandoned the island for 4 years. It just means that after the incident, he obviously lost a lot of control in InGen, because he would have been mainly responsible for what happened at Jurassic Park, but they didn't kick him off completely, because he still had some form of say in InGen until the opening of The Lost World, where you have that little girl getting very seriously hurt by those little compies, little green dinosaurs. If you haven't seen the movie, they're these tiny little green dinosaurs in Jurassic Park. They're cute, or they can be cute, but I guess they also have the most terrifying death because they won't kill you instantly. They're just going to kind of eat you piece by piece, which would be terrifying. But that's getting a little bit off track. Anyway, all in all, I think the facts and science add up to support the hurricane hitting the island in June of 1995. I still strongly believe that this could make for an awesome movie or TV show of some kind, and could possibly lead into the ethically and legally questionable amalgam testings for Jurassic Park 3, which was creating new animals through ways of illegal experimentation and such, like the Spinosaurus. Will they do this movie, or will they do this TV show? Probably not. Rumors and trusted leakers are saying they're already planning a sequel to Jurassic World Rebirth with Gareth Edwards and Scarlett Johansson returning, so who knows what that will be about. I just hope the writing's better in the next one. I did not like how simple the writing was. Like, again, as I said, nothing wrong with simple writing, but I just think it would have been cooler to have a more thought-provoking, I guess, intro to this whole new era of Jurassic Park after advertising the last one as the end of the era or whatever you want to call it. If you can't tell, I'm a huge Jurassic Park nerd. But anyway, we're going to go on a short break now. It is currently 11:16, 11 degrees now. Feels like 10. We're getting to those double digits, again, with a tiny, crisp wind chill in the air. I can still see that bright, beautiful blue sky in the air, so 1 second. Sorry, there's my producers there. I'll wrap this up shortly. Yeah, so that beautiful sky in the air in Waterloo, Ontario. I usually like to play us into breaks after movie-related segments with songs from the movie I talked about. You know, a reason I like The Lost World so much is because of its soundtrack. It's just so different from the original, you know, uses different instruments, while still keeping the same feel of what John Williams did for the original. So, without further ado, I'm going to play us into the break with The Lost World by John Williams on Radio Laurier. Welcome back from the break, and welcome back to Weather Aware with Liam, presented by The Morning Show. You know, I just love that piece from the Lost World soundtrack. I love most of the soundtracks from that movie, honestly. And if you can get past very weird baby T-Rex noises, I very much recommend the movie. Anywho, this next topic is a bit of a throwback topic, honestly. On episode 3 of Weather Aware last year, and I promise this is just a huge coincidence, very big coincidence, I promise you. Last season, on episode 3 of Weather Aware, I discussed the weather scene in Jurassic Park, the fictional storm that happens in the 1993 movie. But really, I just talked about all the cool weather effects and stuff and a cool story about how the T-Rex animatronic got so soaked with the fake rain they used that it started moving on its own. It's a whole thing. Really cool stuff. But strangely enough, I never actually went into depth about what the actual storm that hit the filming location was like. I had one quote from Sam Neill, which plays my favorite character, Alan Grant, goated paleontologist. So, again, in a completely unintentional coincidence, I cannot stress that enough, I'll finally be going into depth about Hurricane Iniki on Season 2, Episode 3 of Weather Aware. After talking about the fiction, after briefly mentioning it a whole season ago on Season 1 of Episode 3. So, as always, before getting started, how about a quick meteorological synopsis? Strangely enough, the origin of Iniki is still unclear, but it's thought to have begun as a tropical wave that exited the West African coast on August 18th. It moved westward across northern South Africa, America, and Central America, entering the eastern Pacific Ocean on August 28th. On September 5th, Tropical Depression 18E developed from the wave about 2,490 kilometers southwest of Hilo, Once it formed from a tropical depression, the National Hurricane Center anticipated minimal strengthening over the subsequent few days. Warm sea surface temperatures around 1 to 3 degrees Celsius above normal were considered a positive factor. On September 6th, the depression crossed 140W, entering the area of warning responsibility of the Central Pacific Hurricane Center. Which sounds a little not complicated, but it's not simple. But, and I might get into the whole stuff about jurisdictions on what weather companies issue warnings for what, but essentially once the storm crossed the 140W, it was no longer the responsibility of the National Hurricane Center, but now the responsibility of the Central Pacific Hurricane Center to issue warnings and such. On that day, the Central Pacific Hurricane Center anticipated that the depression would dissipate within 24 hours and ceased issuing advisories, which was a very, very interesting choice. But life found a way, and the depression reorganized on the next day, and warnings were reissued. Steered by a subtropical ridge to the north, the depression continued westward, or slightly south of due west. On September 8th, the Central Pacific Hurricane Center upgraded the depression to a tropical storm status, giving it the name Iniki, which is Hawaiian for a sharp and piercing wind. Iniki would end up strengthening up to a Category 4 hurricane on September 11th, where an aircraft observed maximum sustained winds of 233 kilometers an hour, with gusts up to 278 kilometers per hour at its peak, making it Category 4. Hurricane Iniki would weaken slightly after its peak, and its eye would make landfall on the southern coast of Kauai near Waimea, with winds of 230 kilometers per hour, making it the strongest hurricane on record to strike Hawaii. Hurricane Iniki was the costliest hurricane ever to strike Hawaii, causing $3.1 billion in damages. That made it the third costliest U.S. hurricane at the time, being right behind Hurricane Hugo in 1989 and Hurricane Andrew in August 1992. It was the first significant hurricane to threaten the actual state of Hawaii since Hurricane Iwa 10 years earlier. Iniki affected all of Hawaii with high waves and strong winds, with the worst impacts on Kauai. 7 people died during the hurricane, 3 on Kauai, 2 offshore, and 2 on Oahu. There were also around 100 storm-related injuries throughout the state, some of which occurred during the hurricane's aftermath. Getting into specifics, Kauai saw the worst of the impacts of Iniki. Landfall in south-central Kauai and moved across the island in 40 minutes, swept the entire island. Much of the island experienced sustained winds of 160 to 190 kilometers per hour. Wind gusts were estimated at 282 kilometers per hour at landfall, and there was an uncalibrated wind gust of 349 kilometers per hour at Makaha Ridge, at the top of a cliff. A station at Makahuena Point recorded a gust of 230 kilometers per hour. Based on the island's damage patterns, meteorologist Ted Fujita, known as Mr. Tornado, and what the Fujita scale, which is used to rate tornadoes, and was what I mentioned earlier with that whole Fujita scale, is named after. The Ted Fujita. Big name in weather lore and weather history. So Ted Fujita estimated there were as many as 26 microbursts, which are little tornadoes, sudden downdrafts of wind capable of reaching 320 kilometers per hour. There were also 2 mini swirls, which are small localized swirls within the eyewall of Iniki. In general, the winds descending the island's mountains were more damaging than the upslope winds. In addition to its strong winds, Iniki lashed the southern Kauai coastline with a 13 to 20 foot storm surge, or a rise in water. On top of the surge, the hurricane produced wave heights of 17 feet with a high watermark of 22.2 feet at Waikomo Stream near Koloa. The high waves left a debris line more than 800 feet inland. Because it moved quickly through the island, there were no reports of significant rainfall, which means, again, because it moved so quickly through the island, there was not actually a sustained and significant amount of rainfall happening. Aniki would end up damaging 14,350 homes. Only the western part of the island was not severely damaged. Aniki destroyed 1,421 houses, including 63 that were lost from the high waves and water. It also severely damaged 5,152 homes, while 7,178 received minor damage, which left more than 7,000 people homeless. High waters damaged several hotels along the island's southern shore. A few were restored quickly, but some took several years to be rebuilt. One hotel, the Coco Palms Resort, famous for Elvis Presley's Blue Hawaii, the movie, by the way, not the song Blue Hawaii. I guess technically the song, because the movie was based on the song and this whole thing, but Blue Hawaii, the movie, which, if you didn't know, Elvis was a not great movie star. But yeah, the Coco Palms Resort, famous for that, Blue Hawaii, never reopened. Aniki's high winds also downed 26% of the island's transmission poles, 37% of its... 37% of its distribution poles, and 35% of its 1,300-kilometer distribution wire system. Electric companies restored only 20% of the island's power service within 4 weeks of Hurricane Aniki, while other areas had no power for 3 to 4 months. Aniki would also end up messing with the island's agriculture. Much of the sugarcane had been already harvested, thankfully, but what was left was severely damaged. The winds destroyed tender tropical plants like bananas and the papayas, and uprooted or damaged fruit and nut trees. The high winds stripped much of Kauai of its vegetation, wrecking sugarcane fields as well as fruit and nut trees. Kauai is a very famous island for all of its movie shoots. You know, think Indiana Jones, Raiders of the Lost Ark, King Kong, 1976, and Jurassic Park. I'll only go over this a little briefly, and I'll give you a different perspective here. Since I did talk about this part of the storm one whole season ago, but the hurricane scene in Jurassic Park is Hurricane Aniki. Steven Spielberg and the entire crew, including the cast, had to hunker down and stay safe, hoping for the best. Despite the order to shelter, Spielberg went out and filmed Hurricane Aniki hitting the coastal walls, and that was used in Jurassic Park. They just don't make them like they used to, I'll tell you that much. We went from recording real hurricanes to a bunch of green screens. Gotta go back to that more 80s and 90s and 70s, that whole era of filmmaking. We gotta go back to that. Let's make practical effects real again, guys. Let's make practical effects great again. As for the aftermath, many were relieved to have survived the worst of the hurricane, but this quickly changed to an anxious feeling due to lack of information. You see, every single radio station was out and no news was available for several days. So there was this, they were pretty much an isolated community with no way of contacting the outside world. Because Aniki knocked out electrical power for most of this island, communities held parties to consume perishable food from unpowered refrigerators and freezers, and many hotels prepared and hosted free meals to use up their perishables. Though some food markets allowed those affected to take what they needed, many Kauai citizens insisted on paying. In addition, entertainers from all of Hawaii, including the Honolulu Symphony, gave free concerts for the victims. In the months after the storm, many insurance companies left Hawaii. To combat this, Governor John D. Waihi III enacted the Hurricane Relief Fund in 1993 to help unprotected Hawaii residents. the fund was never needed for another Hawaii hurricane, and thus it was eliminated in 2000 when insurance companies returned to the island. Oh, I didn't... That's not my notes for some reason. Okay, yeah. So pretty much after Hurricane Iniki hit in 92, after the hurricane, the governor ended up enacting this whole law to help unprotected Hawaii citizens. And many insurance companies left. And personally, it's pretty scummy of them to leave when they needed the insurance most. I'll say that much. Like, yeah, you're an insurance company. Your whole job is to be protecting these citizens from incidents like this, and you leave after they need the insurance? Come on now. What are we doing here? What are we doing? In animal aftermath, Iniki ravaged multiple islands' native forest bird population. The last known Kauai o'o, which is a very pretty little black bird. Nice little white hints to it as well. Is the last known species of that kind of bird is believed to have been killed by Iniki, and the death of this individual also marked the extinction of the entire Mahoide family, which is also known as the Hawaiian honey eaters. By the year 2000, the bird would officially be marked as extinct, at least according to my notes. It is also thought that the storm blew apart many chicken coops, some possibly being used to house fighting chickens, and this caused a dramatic increase in, and this is a real thing, it's a thing that exists if you didn't know, caused a dramatic increase in feral chickens roaming Kauai. Sounds hilarious, but I would argue that Waterloo has some feral chickens of their own. The goose, the geese. And speaking from personal experience, it is terrifying. So I can assume it would only be terrifying to be chased down by an actual feral chicken. So I'm not going to poke fun at it for the most part, but I will say the idea of feral chickens is pretty funny. But again, I assume it would be very scary to be chased down by a feral chicken. So yeah, that was Hurricane Iniki, a very powerful hurricane, you know, the most powerful in Hawaiian history, that led to many things. The destruction of homes, lots of feral chickens, and footage for Jurassic Park. It also led to some documentaries. You can check out Iniki Jurassic, an episode of the Weather Channel's quote-unquote storm stories. As a Jurassic Park fan, I will also quickly plug in and recommend watching The Making of Jurassic Park, which is a documentary about the making of Jurassic Park, which gives a glimpse into what it was like for cast and crew during the hurricane. There's also just a lot of cool footage of Hurricane Iniki out there. See, it happened during the day, so a lot of residents were able to actually record what happened. So there's a lot of cool footage of the hurricane from there, a lot of cool documentaries, and as a bonus, you can see the making of Jurassic Park, which does include footage from Hurricane Iniki, the whole surviving Hurricane Iniki thing, as well as some cool behind the scenes with animatronics and puppetry and acting and all that cool stuff. That being said, it is 11:37. We have just over 20 minutes. And there's not enough time for a short break. So we are going to move into the last segment of the show. I know. It's so sad. It's so tragic. But don't worry. I'll be back soon. Not as soon as you might think, but I'll be soon. Because it is reading week next week. So, moving into the weekly forecast, nothing is 100% with the feature forecast, hence why I'm only going to give you a basic overview, especially for the latter of these days. It is subject to and is likely going to change. This weekly forecast is going to be more important than others, since it'll be your official reading week forecast. What do I have to say about it? Well, I got some good news, folks. Things aren't looking to be too crazy. It'll be your normal October, normal, colder, but normal October weather, I guess, if you want to call it normal. It's not going to be nice. How about that? If you want any bad news, it's not going to be as nice as it was last week, but it's not going to be abnormally cold like it was this morning, because for the most part, the trend is your friend. Starting out with Sunday, October 12th, you're looking at a high of 7, low of 7, a 10-degree difference there. And you're looking at a moderate risk of rain, but otherwise cloudy. On Monday, October 13th, you're looking at a high of 19, a low of 8, and it'll be partly cloudy. On Tuesday, October 14th, you're looking at a high of 20, low of 6, and partly cloudy. On Wednesday, October 15th, you're looking at a high of 15, low of 3, and partly cloudy. And on Thursday, October 16th, a whole week from now, it'll be high of 14, low of 5, and mostly cloudy. So, in general, it'll be nothing crazy, but it's not your spring break by any means. If you want my advice, since it'll be a more colder, cloudy week, I would say time to get cozy, you know, relax with your family and friends and do whatever makes you happy, but be aware that it'll be crisp and cool. More on reading week later in the segment. Moving into my trademark Liam's locked in forecast for the weekend, if you want to call it locked in for the weekend, how about end of the week into the weekend? We can call it that. My trademark guaranteed 3-day forecast. Today, you're looking at a high of 13, low of 0, and it'll be sunny all day, which I can back up for the most part looking outside right now. This morning, it was at 8 a.m., it was 0 degrees, felt like minus 2, but there was some relief as it was sunny. But in about 20 minutes or so, things will quickly warm up as it should be 10 degrees, feels like 9, and sunny. By 5 p.m. tonight, it'll be 12 degrees and sunny, but by 10 p.m., things will cool down a lot. It'll be 4 degrees, feels like 3, and clear skies. So there's going to be no clouds. And, you know, maybe it's not the greatest night to go see the stars in Waterloo Park, but if you are bundled up, I do recommend it. On Friday, there's going to be a high of 17, a low of 8, and partly cloudy. So things are going to warm up for a bit in general. Tomorrow morning, it'll be 1 degree. Great. 1 degree tomorrow morning, I guess. Yeah, 1 degree tomorrow morning. Can't wait for that 8:30 walk to class tomorrow. But it'll be mostly sunny. So, not all is lost. Not all is lost. Thankfully, though, by 12 p.m., things will rapidly heat up. With it being 13 degrees, feels like 12, so there's a tiny wind chill going on and partly cloudy. By 5 p.m. tomorrow, it'll be 16 degrees, feels like 15, and partly cloudy. And by 10 p.m., it'll be 10 degrees, feels like 9, and partly cloudy. So the sun starts to go away for a while after this Friday, tomorrow. But it will be, in general, it will be sunny for the most part, moving into the afternoon. But it should start getting cloudy around mid-afternoon, moving into the evening, and then at night, again, not clear skies, but it will be warm. So still a great night to go out and party. Well, not warm, but warmer than 4 degrees tonight. So, in general, as I said, great night for going out to the city, partying. And in general, it is a great night to kick off reading week, depending on which day or night that you see kicking off reading week. Because you could see Saturday kicking off reading week. And moving into Saturday, you're looking at a high of 17, a low of 7, a risk of rain, but otherwise cloudy. I want to note that if you're heading up to the St. Jacob's Farmers Market, I want you to especially pay attention here so you know how to dress. Because with Thanksgiving coming up on Monday or Sunday, whenever you celebrate it, St. Jacob's Market is definitely a good place to go. At 8 a.m. on Sunday, it's not Sunday, sorry, at 8 a.m. on Saturday, not Sunday, it'll be 9 degrees, feels like 8 with a small chance of rain, but otherwise cloudy. By 12 p.m., it'll be 15 degrees, feels like 14 and mostly cloudy. By 5 p.m., it'll be 15 degrees and mostly cloudy. And by 10 p.m., you're looking at some showers are expected to be moving in, but nothing crazy. It will last into Sunday. Sunday, that aforementioned moderate risk of rain, it should move into Sunday with that rain, but otherwise, it'll be 11 degrees at 10 p.m. Feels like 10 and cloudy. So, nothing crazy on Saturday. It's just a nice cloudy fall day. So, again, if you're heading up to St. Jacob's, dress appropriately. I would also probably check back Friday evening, Saturday morning even, to see when that rain arrives. Because, again, even with these three-day forecasts, it can be kind of tricky. And with a rain risk in the morning, who's to say when? Like, here, let me check right now. Okay, yeah, so my weather source just updated. So as for the rain, it says that there's going to be a chance of rain around 8 a.m. It should last until 3, but it's all below 1 millimeter, so I'm not going to take that as anything concrete. I would honestly, okay, I would just expect a nice, calm, cloudy fall day on Saturday with a chance of rain here and there. So dress appropriately for that. And for a quick overview for my beloved Mississauga listeners, expect warmer temperatures, but still within fall temps. Highs of 17 and 18 for the next 3 days and lows of 13 and 12. And overall for the next week or so, it'll be a cooler side, but a nice average fall week, you know. It's still going to be pretty cold, nothing crazy. It's just a tad bit warmer than Waterloo is getting, which I am very envious of. I guess I won't be in Waterloo for that week. I'll be in Mississauga, so yay me. All right, so moving to the Laurier exclusive news segment, I am saddened to report that there is absolutely nothing to report on since it's near reading week, except for sports, because as always, there are sports. Tonight, you got the men's hockey team facing off against York at the Waterloo Memorial Recreation Complex in Waterloo at 7 p.m. Tomorrow, you got the football team versus Carleton at the Knight Newborough Field at University Stadium, which should be right across from Waterloo College Hall at 7 p.m. I hear the football team is fantastic, and they have been on a roll this season, so definitely go check them out if you can. Men's basketball versus Regina as well tomorrow night at the Athletic Complex Gym in Waterloo, also at 7 p.m. So I guess you're going to have to choose. Are you more of a football guy or more of a basketball guy? That is up to you. But either way, I would go and support our school teams. And finally, on Saturday, you got the men's basketball team versus Dalhousie at the Athletic Complex Gym, Waterloo. You all know where it is, at 7 p.m., as well as the men's hockey team coming back to face Windsor at the Waterloo Memorial Recreation Complex in Waterloo at 7 p.m. You can get your tickets for those and more at laurier.universitytickets.com. I repeat, that is laurier.universitytickets.com. If you're staying on campus, I do have some fresh hot off the stove news for you. Here are the reading week hours for some of the buildings on campus. Because I know some of you like to stay on campus or just stay in Waterloo in general. So if you are, here are the reading week hours. Fred Nicholas Campus Center should be open at regular times. The student union's desk will be closed starting on Friday, October 10th at 4 p.m. and reopens Monday, October 20th at 9 a.m. WILFS will be closed starting Friday, October 10th at 8 p.m. and reopen on Monday, October 20th at 11:30 a.m. The food bank will be open. Hawk Walk, which, if you didn't know about Hawk Walk, if you need help walking home at night, for example, it will be closed during reading week. It'll be closing on Saturday, October 11th at 11 a.m. and reopen Monday, October 20th at 6:30 p.m. And finally, I didn't even know we had this, the Students' Rights Advisory. Have no clue what that is, but it will be open. If you know what that is, it'll be open. They have a picture here of a lease agreement. So I'm assuming the Student Rights Advisory has something to do with student housing. So be on the lookout for that. And before I end off today's episode, I do just want to wish everybody a... Here it is. Sorry. I just want to wish everybody a fan-freaking-tastic reading week. Honestly, it's very shocking that we've made it through half a semester already. Like, can you believe it? Feels like just yesterday we started up again. I moved back in Waterloo. It's crazy, man. It's really crazy. We're already half a semester through. I want you to make sure to take some time to relax, de-stress, and rejuvenate yourself through whatever means that is. Like for me, for example, I'll be heading back to my hometown, chilling with my family and my pets. Dude, I can't wait to see those guys again. Last time I went back, my youngest dog, our oldest youngest dog, Ivy, I came in wearing stuff that she never saw, right? She comes up, tilts her head, and as soon as I take off my sunglasses, she goes crazy because she finally sees it's me. She loves me, man. She loves me. I can't wait to see her again. I can't wait to see everyone at home again. I've missed them a lot. I can't wait to see them. But I also really hope my bearded dragon comes out of brumation. I would like to see her during reading week. And hopefully I also have some fun with friends back in my hometown and catch up on any shows or games I need to catch up on. Primarily, I'm going to focus on Dexter. You know, I'm almost done Dexter, which is a fantastic show, by the way. I can definitely recommend it. But, you know, I'm sure I'll finish it by the time reading week is over with the 3 spinoffs as well. If you got any midterms coming up after reading week, I already finished mine. It went very well. But if you have any coming up still, I got 3 words for you. You got this, all right? All that's important is that as long as you try your best and do the best job that you could, which I know you will, all listeners to Dear Laurier, and specifically Weather Aware, tend to do better on their exams than others. It's a fun fact for you. Totally real fun fact. As long as you do your best, you'll be fine. And if you don't do well on your exams, you know what? That's okay, because as long as you tried your best, that's all that matters. And at the end of the day, it's just a midterm. You're going to have more opportunities to do better. You're going to take this as a learning experience if you don't do well, and I know you'll be able to bounce back in the case you don't do well. But I do know that you all will do well. Because again, Radio Laurier listeners do better than most on exams. I do want to mention that I will not be on the air next week. That is what I meant by not being back as soon as you might think. I will not be on the air next week as it is reading week. I'll be resting my vocal cords for the week and I'll be hanging out with my friends and family. But I will be back in 2 weeks, October 23rd, well rested and ready to deliver your weekly forecast and more once again. I will also once again promote my co-hosts. All of them are great. And a little birdie told me that you may or may not hear a familiar voice tonight on Gabe's After Class show from 10 to 11 p.m. Who knows? Who's to say? I can't say for sure. A little birdie told me. I guess you'll just have to tune in and find out for yourself. But if you can't make it tonight, make sure to catch at least some of the other Radio Laurier shows. We got a lot of good stuff on Radio Laurier. and it might make you do better in exams. So there's that. And with that, all right, before I start the conclusion, little conclusion spiel I always give, I made a last-minute change to the song I was going to play. Originally, I was going to play Morning Glory by Oasis, but I figured I'd play a different song because I feel like I could say Morning Glory for another day. I love that song, and I definitely want to save it for when it's right, and I think I'd rather save it for a better time. So I did some. I've been doing some practicing during the musical breaks, and we are going to try this live. I like to practice my music breaks. As you know, I like talking over the music so I can nail it just right. And we're going to be doing this live. We'll do it live. So that was episode 3 of season 2 of Weather Aware, presented by The Morning Show. Laurier's one and only weather radio talk show. Thank you so much for listening, and make sure to catch me in 2 weeks for your weekly forecast and more. Don't forget to follow the official Weather Aware Instagram page at Weather Aware Liam. Hope you have a great day, Golden Hawks. And remember, stay weather aware. Clouds might be getting full, but whatever you do during reading week, I want you to please don't spend your time looking at your phone. Trust me, there are much more productive things to do with your time. A lot more productive things. I'm going to play us off with Tea Slamp by MGMT on Radio Laurier.